So what we're going to do is start off. Sam Harris had, when we first talked about doing this meeting, Sam said, given last year's exposure and so on, that he'd be quite happy not to speak and to let everybody else speak, since it didn't, since it would not be any claims then that he was opining too much. And in fact, he's been remarkably quiet. But I think on this last day, it's only appropriate that he actually have a chance to say something, since he's got some thoughts that have evolved during the first 2 days. Sam is, of course, the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation. He's a graduate in philosophy from Stanford University, I believe, studying with Dick Rorty, the late Richard Rorty, who was going to come to this meeting last year, but sadly was claimed by pancreatic cancer. And Sam is, well, it says here, completing a doctorate in neuroscience. But I talked to Marco Iacoboni last night, and I'm not sure how long that's going to take. So. Sam Harris.
Thank you, Robert. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to be here with all of you. Dan Dennett and I were at a meeting of atheists, an atheist convention actually, about a month ago. And I had the good sense at that meeting to stand up in front of 500 of the most committed atheists in the country and say that atheism as a philosophy was bankrupt and as a word was disastrous, and we should not use the term. This had more or less the effect that any social scientist in this room could have warned me about. I think this was the only talk I had ever been to that began with a standing ovation and ended with some scarcely mammalian sounds of disgruntlement. Incidentally, Dan's talk began with a standing ovation and ended with one, and I noticed that that conduces to a better mood later in the evening. Anyway, Roger asked me to briefly summarize my misgivings with the concept of atheism, and also talk a little bit about what my experience has been since our last meeting, as I have spent much of that time spreading joy to the world by publicly criticizing religion. My concern with the use of the term atheism, and here I'm going to echo something that Michael Shermer said, is that it invites a variety of misunderstandings, and it's philosophically really without content. I mean, we don't need a word like atheist, in the same way we don't need a word for somebody who's not an astrologer. And we simply do not call people non-astrologers. And I don't think we would be tempted to if astrology suddenly became ascendant in our society. All we need are words like reason and evidence and common sense and bullshit to put astrologers in their place. And so it could be with religion. Now, my point with the term atheism, or really any label, naturalist, skeptic, humanist, secular humanist, bright, is that it invites misunderstandings and unnecessarily trims down our constituency. Because the truth is, on any specific question, a majority of people, even in America, functionally reject religious thinking. I mean, you take a question like, and this is from sexual ethics to medical research, you take something like embryonic stem cell research. A majority of Americans already reject the authority of religion on this subject. And so most people, many, many more people than would ever answer to the name of atheist, see on any specific question that there is a conflict between science and religion. I'm sure many of you in this audience are functionally atheists, and yet would never dream of going to an atheist conference or blogging on an atheist website. So it seems to me that if we want to encourage public displays of rationality, rallying people to the banner of atheism, or any banner that suggests that we are a maligned and marginal and cranky interest group, is a bad strategy. Now, the concept of atheism and this designation of the new atheist that is following many of us around like our shadows has confused, I think, even the scientific discussion of religion. I think much of that confusion has been in evidence at this conference. It's in evidence in a debate that we're having online right now. Thomas Nagel is saying what many people at this conference have said, that there is no There's nothing about science that entails a criticism of religion. And there's nothing about science that entails a commitment to atheism. This, I think, is to be misled by words. Words like religion and atheism. I mean, science clearly does not entail that one identify oneself as an atheist, or even think of oneself as an atheist. But science does entail that one be skeptical of unsupported and unsupportable claims about miracles and about the divine origin of certain books. And when you dig into the details, this is all atheism is. Atheism is the failure to be convinced by other people's claims about miracles. And it is the conviction that they too should not be convinced. I mean, is there a conflict between justified and unjustified belief? I mean, this is really where we can see that there's a zero-sum game here between religion and science, because both religion and science are ways of forming beliefs, or they are systems of belief and their justification, or lack thereof. And unfortunately, they are systems that require very different standards of evidence and levels of self-criticism. And therefore, any comparison between religion and science is bound to be invidious. Another problem, another way in which this entanglement is unavoidable between religion and science is that you can't disentangle religious and scientific truth claims. The belief that Jesus was born of a virgin is one of the key doctrines of Christianity. It is also a claim about biology. The belief that he will return to Earth at some point in the future to judge the world entails a variety of claims about history, about the human survival of death, and apparently about the mechanics of human flight without the aid of technology. There is, of necessity, conflict between religion and science here. Now, people like Deirdre McCluskey have alleged that the atheist criticism of religion always focuses on the most benighted and marginal and Bible-thumping, nitwit version of the faith. And there's a far more sophisticated faith on offer that is untouched by this criticism. It's just not true. I mean, this criticism applies every bit as much to a sophisticated believer like Francis Collins. In fact, more so, because he should know better. He should know that if a frozen waterfall can testify to the divinity of Jesus, anything can testify to anything. So whatever the subject under discussion, there are good reasons for believing things, and there are bad reasons. And the problem here is that religion has made bad reasoning into an art form. And if there is something worth discussing in the experience of a Buddha or a Jesus, as I think there is, I think there really is a there. I think it is possible to have a rare and beautiful and transformative experience. And we can call that spirituality or mysticism. If there's something worthy of discussion there, it should be susceptible to rational inquiry. And we can hold mystics and contemplatives to the highest standards of empirical rigor and logical coherence. It's simply a myth to say that we can't. And many believers, as you know, have taken refuge in Stephen Jay Gould's, I think, quisling formulation of non-overlapping magisteria, the idea that religion and science cannot be in conflict because they represent two different domains of expertise. Well, let's see how this works. Okay, science represents the best authority on the workings of the physical universe. Religion represents the best authority on what exactly? The non-physical universe? Probably not. What about meaning and values and ethics and the good life? Well, here is another myth. The idea that scientific rationality has nothing prescriptive to say about morality and human happiness. I mean, science, we are told, can help us get what we value, but it cannot tell us what we ought to value. I mean, many of us believe that we can scan people's brains while they make a variety of moral judgments, but we'll never be in a position to say what judgments they should have made. That is what judgments are ethically normative. This is a myth, and we have exported this mythology to the culture at large. And now most people think that they are offered a forced choice between the law of God and something like moral relativism. And as a result, most people, even most scientists and secularists, have ceded all discussion about meaning and values and morality to the care of theologians and religious apologists, more or less without argument. And this is what has kept religion in such good standing, even while its authority has been battered and nullified on every other question of significance. Now, I'm convinced this has been a huge mistake, intellectually first, but also politically, morally, even spiritually. Once we understand human happiness, once we understand morality as being inextricable from happiness, not just human happiness, but the difference between happiness and suffering in conscious creatures like ourselves, then we see that it will be susceptible to empirical inquiry and rational discussion. I mean, are there objective facts to be known about the causes of human happiness? Surely there must be. I mean, it does not seem too soon to say that love is generally better than hate and compassion better than cruelty. I mean, it may be a very long time, as anyone in this room can appreciate, before we fully understand the basis for the deepest psychological well-being in terms of genes and social structures and economic systems. But it is not too soon to say that something like honor killing doesn't figure prominently in it. And notice that this makes realists of us morally, functional realists. And there does not have to be right, narrow right answers to every moral question for us to be realists. I mean, the difference between right and wrong can be like the difference between food and poison. You know, there's not one right food. There's not one best food. But that does not obviate all distinction between food and non-food. We can have it's quite possible that at the end of the discussion, 10,000 years from now, we will have a band of morally appropriate, which is to say, behaviors and thoughts conducive to the deepest human happiness. In any given situation, it'll be like food as opposed to poison. Now, many scientists and many of you in this room are going to be quick to say that science does not yet have much to say about how best to maximize human happiness. And this is true. But what special competence does a rabbi or imam or priest have on this subject? What special competence does a religious expert have on the subject of whether or not embryonic stem cell research or preventative war or family planning are moral? I think the answer is none. I mean, the truth is, understanding a scriptural tradition is no more relevant to questions of ethics than it is to questions of astronomy. I mean, what are the representatives of our various religions can tell us what their congregations believe on a wide variety of topics, and believe almost invariably on bad evidence. They can tell us what their holy books say you ought to believe in order to escape the fires of hell. But what they can't do, or can do no better than butchers and bakers and candlestick makers, is they can't say why these injunctions are ethical. Is it ethical to kill a person for changing his religion? Now, I would bet my life that the answer to that question is no. Which is to say, I would bet my life that killing people for apostasy is a bad strategy for maximizing human well-being. As it turns out, however, if you poll British Muslims, ages 16 to 24, 36% of them disagree with me and think that people should be killed for leaving their faith. These are British Muslims. As it turns out, they're on firm ground, theologically speaking. The Quran does not explicitly say that apostates should be killed, but the Hadith does. The sacred literature of the Hadith does repeatedly and without equivocation. Is this edict ethical? Is it compatible with a civil society? Is the reliance upon authority that has brought this barbarism to us down through the generations even remotely compatible with science? Now, what can we say about this as scientists? I mean, is it too soon to say that killing people for changing their religion is wrong? Is it too soon to say that it's a terrible strategy for maximizing human happiness? I think not. Conceding this is to concede that some belief systems are worse than others by any criteria we value. Some worldviews are lousy, and it is not unscientific to say so. In fact, it is unscientific not to say so. I mean, Jonathan Haidt was here. Is Jonathan here today? Well, that's too bad. But Jonathan Haidt said that North Korea was clearly beyond the pale. I mean, clearly this is a circumstance of just a human experiment gone awry. These people are needlessly suffering. This is unethical. I await with some feelings of glee his attempt to adumbrate a morality that will focus appropriate condemnation on North Korea, but will leave Islam totally exonerated. I guarantee you that will be a masterpiece of political correctness. The problem with religion is that it is the only mode of thought that systematically closes people to real conversation, because it is the only mode of thought that puts a positive value on a person's perpetual immunity to new evidence and new argument. And this closure is euphemistically called faith, and it is generally thought to be beyond criticism, even by atheist scientists who don't share it. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not advocating new laws. I'm not advocating that we infringe people's religious freedom. I'm advocating new rules of conversation. There is no law against believing that Elvis Presley is still alive. Okay, this is not, how have we kept this belief from invading our boardrooms and our academic departments? The principle of our immunity is really quite simple. Anyone who seriously espouses the idea that Elvis is still alive, either in a lecture or in a job interview or on a first date, immediately pays a consequence in ill-concealed laughter. There's a general principle at work here. People who claim to be certain of things they clearly can't be certain of have a problem meeting their goals in life, except when these certainties are on the subject of religion. But such people do not get asked to run our major corporations on any other subject, when they espouse these certainties on any other subject. They don't get invited to present at conferences. They're apt to find their business cards discreetly placed in the trash. Okay, this is it, notice that we don't have to pass any laws against bad ideas to reliably deliver these rebukes. We simply have to be free to criticize bad ideas. And we are free to criticize bad ideas, except we're not availing ourselves of this freedom on the subject of religion. We have been cowed into silence. We have learned to be terrified of the peevishness and irrationality of our neighbors. And we've learned to fear their suffering, which is, notice, different than feeling compassion for their suffering. We have learned to fear that the only remedy for their day-to-day suffering is the false consolation of false ideas. Well, I'm here to say, after having spoken this way publicly and received tens of thousands of emails, that our neighbors have their doubts. And they don't have any special fondness for being wrong or confused or self-deceived. They don't have a special fondness for having their beliefs not map onto reality. And it seems to me profoundly condescending and unimaginative for secular academics to say, well, we don't need religion, everyone else does, and will for as long as humanity endures. And this of course, is often said and has been often said at this meeting. I mean, we are endlessly reminded that every culture has had religion, that every culture we know about has organized itself around religious superstition and unfounded certainties. And therefore, it is fatuous to think we are ever going to get rid of this kind of thinking. Okay, the same could have been said about witchcraft. Every culture has believed in witches, feared witches, persecuted witches, or relied upon their expertise. It's just crazy to think you're going to get rid of witchcraft. What you have to do is learn to live side by side with witches and warlocks and to accommodate their certainty about the evil eye in public discourse. Okay, imagine how fatuous and embarrassing and dangerous it would have been to have gone down that path on witchcraft. Well, we did go down that path with religion. Thank you very much.
Do you want to
take some questions?
Sure.
So Rex Kerr has got one out there.
I don't want to come out against happiness. It's kind of like coming out against kittens. It seems like something you ought not do. Mm. But if you look at the biological knowledge that we've acquired over the past few hundred years, one of the main things we've learned is that human happiness is, the functional role is to, you know, be an adaptive, to change our behavior in adaptive ways so that we'll be reproductively fit. So my question is whether, you know, I agree with everything that you say about, you know, being able to use science to evaluate what will tend to lead to human happiness. Mm. My question is whether human happiness is a sophisticated enough concept that, you know, maybe there's some other concept, you know, taking more of a Darwinian perspective of adaptation that should actually be primary, and that happiness maybe shouldn't play a central role.
Right, yeah, good question. Well, I think that the term happiness is maybe the wrong term. It seems a little too effete and not, it lacks gravitas. Happiness, well-being, I mean, there's a spectrum of positive psychology that, granted, is not completely understood, and its interaction with the rest of culture and the rest of human life is not understood. But we know the difference between being loving and content and disposed to treat strangers well and being terrorized and neurotic and sociopathic. And there's a spectrum here that we recognize even now and don't need to know much more about to know that we want to be gravitating toward one end as opposed to the other. Now, no doubt, in the limit, as our conversation about this gets really nuanced, you know, biochemically and computationally, when we can dial in certain states with a device, you know, if that day ever comes, then we'll have a much more detailed discussion about what it is to be truly mentally healthy. And maybe our normal sort of consensus trance of egoity and distraction and self-preoccupation is going to seem like a kind of very well-subscribed mental illness. You know, I mean, who knows where this is going? If the singularity is real, you know, and we all get uploaded on the internet in 5 years if Kurzweil's right, or 1,000 years if he's not. I mean, who knows? I'm not prejudging any of those. I mean, some of that sounds frankly crazy to me, but I'm not prejudging any of those debates. I'm just saying that we already know the difference between. We know that when a girl gets raped, and her father and brother and husband and even mother can think of nothing better to do than cut her head off, we know that something's wrong there. In terms of everything we value and should value as a matter of happiness or well-being.
Yeah, I have two related points, and one of them is just this. I think you're absolutely right to defend to criticize the Stephen Jay Gould idea of two magisteria, right? There's ethics, science can't say anything, let's leave it to them. And this is actually now the official position of the AAAS in this recent book that came out about evolution, which I find really troubling. But you seem to be conflating that view with views that have been defended here, the view that I presented on day one, really Johns Heitz view, which is a little bit different. And that's an empirical claim about human cognition, which is that human beings inevitably make these strong evaluations. Cutting off the head of a girl who's just been raped is wrong. And that when people push us on that, they say, well, why is it wrong? The Quran says we need to do this, or tradition says we need to do this. We then rely on beliefs that are empirically unverifiable in the sense that happiness is good is not something you could ever really prove scientifically, right?
That's the move that I'm objecting to. I mean, I think this is a larger discussion about how the consequentialist can win his debate with the Kantian or the deontologist. And I think he can. I mean, I'm not prepared to go to the mat with all the philosophers on that point. I think we can actually beg that question to get more of what we want in this world at the moment. But I think actually, if you probe that statement that we can't say that happiness is good, mm-hmm. We can say that happiness is conducive to happiness. I mean, if goodness, in my terms, is just a matter of psychological well-being, then that bites its own tail, and all we have to talk about is what is going to maximize well-being. And for you to then make
a very clear move of saying,
but is that good? I can say no. If you give me a new version of well-being, I'm willing to talk about it.
Okay, so you're not convinced that you know what happiness is. Because what I hear from you is you accepting kind of, well, happiness is what's portrayed in this magazine that's in my hotel room, or it's beautiful people eating tapas and of going on. That's what happiness is. And different people at different times have very different ideas about what happiness
is.
So we can't prejudge that we as unmarked moderns kind of have just emerged from history and actually have an ahistorical true concept of what happiness is.
I'm very much a realist on questions of happiness and suffering. And again, with the analogy to food seems relevant to me, because it's not that we're ever going to come down to, hummus is the perfect food,
right,
and everything else suffers by comparison. Likewise, with different ways of relating and ways of thinking about oneself and uses of attention. But there is a band where an honor killing is not on it, and much of Islam is not on it, and much of the sexual taboos of our religions are not on it. And we know enough now to say that. So I just think but again, this conversation about what constitutes well-being is like any scientific conversation is truly open-ended, and the difficulty is in verifying various claims, and it would be a completed science of the mind that would verify these claims. Who knows if we'll get there?
So. Mike over there. Jeff, go ahead.
Jeff Hawkins. You started your talk admonishing us for using the word atheist and being self-identified as atheist, and I agree with that. I'm wondering, and if you would agree with this, that we might be making the same mistake by using the word religion. It's a very inclusive term that many people identify with many different things, and sometimes you in your own conversation slide between using the word religion and unfounded beliefs.
Right.
If we just say that false beliefs are the problem, not religion per se, but false beliefs, unfounded beliefs, it might ameliorate sort of the tension in the conversation quite a bit, and get us focused on what the real problem is. I'm just curious if you've thought about that, if you would agree with that, or if you think there's any value in that sort of banning us from using the word religion as a thing we're disagreeing with.
Yeah. Well, dogma for me really is the problem. It's not just false beliefs. It's having no mechanism or no inclination to vet your beliefs. It's the moral of the Doubting Thomas story, the idea that somehow strongly held beliefs in the absence of evidence or in spite of evidence are somehow ennobling, or especially ennobling. So it's holding to false beliefs with both hands, smugly and unctuously. That's the problem. It just so happens that religion is the only language game in which that is practiced with impunity. And people even, and it's protected from within by religious dogmatism and an unwillingness to talk reasonably about the beliefs, and it's protected from without by people like ourselves who are loath to criticize religion because it's religion. I mean, it's held under this, the term religion, I would argue, is actually misleading in another way, because we use it as though it named one class of human preoccupation, and it's, I mean, religion's a word like sport. I mean, some sports are dangerous, and some aren't. You got Thai boxing, and then you got, you know, lawn bowling. They're both sports. You know, one is going to get somebody killed, and one is, you know, you don't even have to be in shape to play. So what, I mean, what do they have in common as sports? Beyond breathing, I'm not sure what it is. Well, yeah, so, but the problem is we do use the word religion, and it provides a kind of an exculpatory, the reason why I have to use the word religion is because religion is sheltered, religion as religion is sheltered from criticism in a way that no other form of thinking is. I mean, just look, for instance, at the difference between what happened to James Watson when he went off half-cocked about race, and what happened to, what didn't happen to Francis Collins, when he wrote a scarcely sane justification of evangelical Christianity. I mean, he got good reviews in Nature, twice. His thinking in those lines is actually more offensive to me as a rational person than Watson's, frankly. I mean, I think, you know, I'm not defending Watson, but at least Watson had a point of contact with evolutionary theory. And can be only convicted, I think, perhaps he can be convicted of being less than ethical in being interested in that data or in his construal of the data. But Collins is just, it's an utter repudiation of scientific standards. And yet, because it was a religious repudiation of scientific standards, he got lionized, actually, in Nature, of all places. I invite you to read the reviews and read his book.
Yeah. Sam, it's okay. Jerry back here in the back. Thank you for your remarks. They were eloquent and cogent, and they cut right to the heart of a crucially important, subtle aspect of this, and I commend you for that. My question is, where do you suggest we go from here, and how? And what level of optimism might you have? We all know that reason has not worked, despite all the predictions of the end of faith, if I may, through the decades and centuries. And I'm not optimistic from that perspective. I am optimistic, though, that in this increasingly globalized, smaller world with intermingling of cultures and traditions and mores and doctrines, and multiculturalism existing more and more in every single culture throughout the world, and communications and so forth and so on, that any one culture with its own traditions, as their young people grow up, are going to find it less easy and less inclined to have a need to stick to traditional faith and other such things. So I am something of an optimist. I think the upshot of that might be an increase in New Ageism, with the traditional faiths increasingly in decline. But I'll take that over what we've experienced to date. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I share that optimism. I mean, it's hard to say that I'm an optimist. I don't see this happening as quickly as it needs to. But yeah, we have a choice between conversation and violence. Ultimately, I mean, when push comes to shove, when things really matter, we can either talk to each other, negotiate, or we have to pull out the guns or rockets. You know, if someone sees a third alternative, I'd be happy to have it pointed out. But we talk until we can't talk any longer. And the problem with dogmatism, in my mind, especially religious dogmatism, is it is a conversation stopper. That's a Rortian phrase. But it is. I mean, there's nothing that incompatible fundamentalisms can say to each other to really place their beliefs on the table and get them modified in anything like real time. And the only thing that guarantees that our collaboration with one another is truly open-ended as a species, in my mind, is that we are willing to have our beliefs and behaviors revised through conversation, through new arguments and new evidence. And it's only on religion that the antithetical spirit is celebrated. Celebrated even by secularists who don't share this spirit, but who think everyone else needs to indulge it to get through their day. And that's really what I see as the purpose of a meeting like this, that we thrash this out until there's no longer really doubt on our side that we need, that we have a problem here, that we have a war of ideas that needs to be won. And then the question is how to win it. I can be convicted of radical impracticality, perhaps. Or maybe there's a role for different voices. So I don't know if that addresses the center of your question, but I don't have a program apart from making noises at the appropriate moment and funding those noises and funding dissent. You know, I think funding dissent in the Muslim world, for instance, inspiring it, protecting dissidents in the Muslim world, that is a discrete project that has to happen and has to happen in a huge way. How we do that is a question of pragmatics.
Very nice talk. It's because I'm an empiricist that I can't cast off religion with the same missionary zeal as many of the people here. And I'll point out that many people are functionally empiricists in many ways. They will not pray their way across the country. They'll take an airplane that has had engineers. When they're suffering pain, they may pray, but they'll pray with Vicodin, making use of the findings that we've gleaned from medical science. They generally will not choose to drink a bottle of bleach because they'll have heard that science shows and empirical evidence shows this will be bad for them unless with suicidal intent, and even that will be capitalizing on evidence that they have gained from science. Right. So in cases where evidence clearly shows things that are in their adaptive best interest, people rely on empirical evidence. And the question is whether religion isn't also used because of its adaptive benefits. There is empirical evidence that people who are religious adjusting for those factors we can think of to adjust for have better health outcomes, and there are some obvious reasons why this might be the case. There's social support, and even social activity has strong health benefits. There's practical support in times of need. And okay, also,
those are confounds, by the way, that you're now listing. I mean,
No. They're mediating factors.
Right. Well, mediating factors are confounds.
No.
A confounder
by definition is the factor that is associated with the outcome in the unexposed population and is not in the causal pathway. So it is not a confounder, it's a potential mediating factor. And also it can provide great comfort in times of excruciating loss if somebody loses a child. And I'll argue that a small child carries a stuffed animal around with them for comfort. Part of their brain knows it's just a stuffed animal, but it provides comfort nonetheless, and perhaps some people even hold religion with the same kind of part of their brain providing for the comfort. The other issue is that stress has been shown to have great health consequences. People with major stressors in their life have higher hospitalizations and mortality, and there's a large body of literature showing that when people feel that they have a sense of control over their stress, the stress has less bad health benefits.
I have the spirit of your... Do you want me to respond?
I'll just add one other element, which is I am against incitement to violence in all of its forms and agree that religion should not be a privileged bastion. If there are political elements within a religion, those should be treated as political. If there is incitement to violence, those should be treated as incitement. But religion doesn't inherently entail incitement to violence, and lack of religion doesn't inherently preclude it. And I'm a little concerned about the conflating of religion with some of its bad elements here.
All right, so I want that last statement to echo in your mind. Religion doesn't intrinsically entail incitement to violence. This is a problem with using the term religion as though Jainism and Salafi Islam were the same orientation. There are certain religious teachings that absolutely do incite violence. The doctrines of martyrdom and jihad within Islam, and it's not just Al-Qaeda-style Islam, these are not ideas that are just rattling around the heads of the 15,000 people who went to training camps. I mean, that we're talking about a significant subset of the Muslim world who think martyrdom and jihad are real principles of salvation. That you get into heaven by dying in the right circumstances, and the right circumstances entail killing infidels when there's a collision between Islam and the rest of humanity. But your argument is that religion is useful, that religion helps people, it relieves stress, it consoles people.
Religion are useful, but
Yeah. Okay. The utility, yes, but the utility argument, though, is separate from the truth argument. I mean, to say that religion is useful is not at all to say that it is true. Okay, and so we as scientists, we're in the truth business. We're not in the useful delusion business. I mean, I could invent a religion right now that I guarantee you would be more useful than any religion on offer. And if we could spread it to billions, we would live in a better world, and this religion would be transparently false to everyone in this room. It would be a lie. I mean, here's the religion. You know, help people to the best of your ability. Don't lie, cheat, or steal. And here's where it gets novel. Raise your children to value science and mathematics and excel in these areas as best as they can. And if you don't do this, you'll be tortured after death by a 17-headed demon named Phyllis. Okay. Now, if we could spread this all over the world, if we could replace Islam with this faith, we would live in a better world. Absolutely. Okay? Does that lend the slightest credence to the idea that this demon named Phyllis exists? No. So we have to talk like this as scientists. You seem to be arguing that there are other ways to be consoled. And again, a thoroughgoing approach to human happiness and even human contemplative experience. I mean, I'm alone among many atheists, I think, in really being interested in mystical experience and in seeking out those experiences. And you know, I've helped organize a retreat for scientists, the third of which is happening next month, where we're going to have 100 scientists sitting in silence for a week, practicing meditation, and then talking for 2 days about the relevance of that to discussions in the cognitive sciences. All of that can be done rationally without presupposing anything on insufficient evidence.
I guess I would comment that many people here have said that high values in our society are, for example, sanctity of life and minimization of suffering. And if we hold those values and believe in using evidence to maximize the fruition of those values, then what you're saying is, supposing the evidence in religion has a causal foundation, let's teach our children. I don't think there's any problem with teaching people to have beliefs based on evidence and hold those to one side, but let's teach our children to have this set of beliefs even knowing that they'll die sooner as a result.
Well, there are problems in getting really clear about what constitutes compassion and the relief of human suffering and why it's practiced. I mean, you know, nothing is more disorienting to me than Danny Kahneman's lecture about colonoscopies. I mean, I don't know if you guys have heard this, but it turns out that if you give someone a colonoscopy and end it as soon as possible, they actually reliably report more suffering and are less likely to ever get a colonoscopy again than if you end it slowly in a leisurely way, just keep the tube in and prolong their discomfort, but you taper their discomfort off for many more minutes. So the compassionate thing to do in that moment is actually prolong somebody's suffering. It's an interesting fact about human psychology, which has apparently been demonstrated. We can talk in a very open-ended way about what we want done to ourselves, what we want done to our kids, what is sane to do. And again, there'll be a range of practices. And in that range, you are not going to find much of what goes on in the name of religion. That's my claim.
So Ronnie D'Souza was waiting.
Yes, thank you. I think insofar as we're interested in truth, we could try beginning with what all religions are absolutely right about, namely that every other religion is just a lot of complete rubbishy superstition.
Yeah.
And what I really wanted to say was that while I agree with everything you've said, I think that you were insufficiently...
heretical.
You were too receptive to the idea that adaptivity or adaptiveness should be something that might be substituted for happiness. Because I think it's important to remember that the way that natural selection works, there's absolutely no reason to think that what's adaptive is good for any of us in particular.
Absolutely.
And as a matter of fact, even if you believe in group selection, there's no reason to think that natural selection is good even for groups or even for species. After all, most species are extinct, right? Yeah, so natural selection couldn't have been all that good for all of them. So I think that it's a really bad idea to think that you're being scientific by suggesting that adaptiveness is somehow something that should be a source of value.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, which I elided. If you want to read a great book on that subject, Lee Silver, I think he's still here, he wrote a book, Challenging Nature, and it hammers away on just that point, that we have romanticized the natural world in that way.
Robert?
Robert Winter, there's a very clear transition between talking and shooting. That's, of course, called economic sanctions, which Bush and the neocons have used very skillfully to ratchet up the pressure and then totally, in their own minds, rationalize the attack that inevitably comes. So I don't think it's just a binary kind of choice there.
Although that could be argued to be a version of shooting. I mean, when people are going to starve and not get medical care, and if you unpack sanctions, effective sanctions, people are suffering mightily.
So. Right. My second point is, it seems to me that the prefix A has been used in all kinds of contexts. I, by the way, prefer to refer to people like yourself and many of us here as reasonists, and the rest of the world as a-reasonists.
Right.
Because it's always the prefix A is always supplied by those who have the power, who have the investment in the current paradigm, to describe those who don't have it. And it makes you look. So when Arnold Schoenberg started writing music in the early 20th century, that no longer really adhered to the tonal structure, which was very much allied with the power structure of Western Europe, he never made up a term for what kind of music he was writing. In fact, he described his whole odyssey there for that old decade as being afloat in a sea of boiling oil. It was so painful and far out and so forth. And so they dubbed him, of course, an atonalist. And even when he came up with a system for composing with 12 tones, they called him the rest of his life an atonal, therefore amoral, therefore, he's a Jew. So he's highly undesirable. And I had his son in my class last week. I was telling some of the folks at dinner last night. And I mean, this thing bothered him more than almost anything in his existence, was to have this sort of label put on him that he could never shake. Finally, my question is, I've heard a number of articulate people like you. Your talk was fantastic. Why don't I see you on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour at least 5% of the time compared to the 95% of the time I see the Christian right being represented in every bloody discussion about almost anything? I never understand why that is, because I don't think they could withstand. I mean, you do see debates occasionally. Cable makes it a little more frequent now, but you're grossly outnumbered in these things, and it distresses me enormously.
Yeah. Well, again, it speaks to this taboo, I think. I mean, the one thing the new atheists can't really complain about so much is a lack of publicity. We have gotten our books sold, and we've gotten interviews. I mean, I haven't been on Lehrer, but I've been out there. But it is utterly swamped, as you point out, by the rest of public piety. And I think unfortunately, and this is something I argued at this atheist convention, that there's something about just calling it atheism that successfully marginalizes it, and so people can dismiss our arguments in our books without even reading them. I mean, in an egregious way, that happened at this meeting. David Sloan Wilson attacked me for my bad science. I asked him what science he was talking about. There's not very much science in my books, actually. I mean, certainly my argument against faith doesn't rely on any construal of evolutionary theory or you're parsing these fights about group selection. And then he came up to me afterwards and admitted he's never read a thing I've written. He just read Dan Dennett and Richard Dawkins and thought that I was of a piece with them. Now, I'm not obviously endorsing his attack on Dan or Richard, but I'm just saying that this is not ad hominem against David Sloan Wilson. It was big of him to admit this, although I would like him to be mic'd when he admits this thing. So I've just mic'd him, but he has been misled by the concept of atheism. He thinks that somehow, you know that someone's an atheist, you basically know everything about their argument against religion.
Okay. We could take maybe one or two more questions. Scott, maybe you'd like to.
Sam, your program about using science to advance a moral philosophy of happiness and well-being is a good one. And the way you propose to do it is a very good one. What is not clear to me is if you think that the proposition that people are better off if they're happy and they suffer less is itself a scientific proposition. Because there have been, and there are today, many people who believe that cruelty, extreme and temporary cruelty, to improve happiness and welfare for the rest of humankind is necessary. Some people who followed Nietzsche and Nechayev believe that to be the case. Mm. They believe that science can and will help them advance this particular moral philosophy. My question is, do you really think that science itself will show one particular moral philosophy to be superior to another, or whether this is an open question and we'll just take whatever comes around? And just one final point. Mm. The present Communist Congress in China invited some of us at the, with partial sponsorship from the Commission on Atheism, which is a government commission, to help prepare China for a new society of harmony based on sort of the 150 million people who have become capitalists now, who are now the new vanguard of the revolution. Mm. And the belief is that there would be a sort of trickle-down effect if science could develop this philosophy of harmony, and the chief impediment to it was superstition. So they have a very similar program. It's not one I would buy into, but there is a third way, a third moral philosophy that could follow very well the precepts you offer. So again, the question is, do you think that the original premises, the moral premises, can be decided by scientific debate?
Well, I think science construed in a larger sense. I mean, there's something called rationality that we distinguish from irrationality. So history is a part of that. I mean, the belief that the Japanese bombed us at Pearl Harbor is a factual belief. And anyone who's going to argue that the people from Borneo did it has a burden to meet. Now, that's not science. I mean, it's history. But this is construing science in that larger sense, that larger footprint of certainty scaling with the evidence. I think, yeah, science is the best we've got. And I think, I mean, there are consequentialist problems, I mean, one of which has been raised at this meeting. I forgot who did it. But yeah, if you're, who among us wants to live in a society where you go to the doctor for a checkup and he realizes that he's got five people who need organs and they just, you know, vivisect you, take your organs, and you know, five people are better off? This is a, you know, I think we can use various rational heuristics to discover that we don't want to live in that society, even though it's hard to do the moral arithmetic and say the integrity of one person's life has to trump five people who need their organs. I mean, this is whether you use a Rawlsian veil of ignorance. We can talk about this and converge, and we're not going to wind up with very likely what the Chinese have in mind at the moment. Also, I just want to say to you, Scott, there's a massive gulf between how you and I think about these issues, particularly the question of Islam. And I don't want my not dealing with that in this talk to signal that I haven't recognized this gulf or that I don't think others should recognize it. I mean, I think your talk, I mean, I thought I had a good theory of mind. I don't know what you are doing with yours in your talk on Islam. And I mean, this should be left for another day, perhaps. But I would grant you almost everything you said in your talk about Islam. I mean, 90% of what you said is true, and yet the general message you draw from it, I think, is utterly false. And you have a style of drawing that message which is, you know, somewhat confabulatory in my mind. I mean, you have a blizzard of detail, much of which is orthogonal to the question at hand, and you know, you basically delivered this idea that, you know, soccer and friendship among men is the problem, explains suicide bombing, better than the explicit doctrines of jihadism and martyrdom and Muslim eschatology. And I think it's irresponsible, and I think you owe it to yourself and you owe it to us to debate someone who can debate you on this subject. I would be happy to debate you on the subject, but the problem that, let me just recognize here, is that there's so much white guilt in every audience you're likely to talk to, that it's not going to take someone like me. It's going to take someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali or someone who got out of Islam, you know, someone who has been punished by Islam, who knows how totalitarian it is, who feels the relief of modernity and secular politics, and who can say to you, you are wrong about Islam, you are wrong about the role that Muslim ideology is playing, and you owe it to yourself to have that conversation publicly with someone who can do that.
All right, well, hang on. Yeah. You actually want to reply to that? Oh,
and you can't reply.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think such a public debate would be proper and good, but it would have to be with someone who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Who has the slightest notion of what's going on out there, and that I haven't seen here.
Okay, well, I'll take that, Philip, but...
Thank you. All right. Austin. So we'll just take Austin Dacey's point, and then we have to move on to Dan Smale.
Austin Dacey with the Center for Inquiry. It's always a pleasure to hear from a fellow non-astronomer.
Astrologer, although non-astronomer also.
Yeah. Non-astronomer.
I'm equally not an astronomer, unfortunately.
An astrologer.
Now, there's an assumption that is at work oftentimes in discussions like these. I've heard it at work this week. It's a tempting assumption, but I think it's one you wish to avoid. I wanted to get your comment, please. The assumption is to think that the social space vacated by the collapse of religion, should it collapse, must be filled in by one single new institution or movement,
right,
which will fulfill all the roles formerly performed by religion. This is a mistake because, as we can see, this is not the way that the secularization of Europe proceeded, for example. It wasn't as though, you know, the Danes stopped going to church and then started going to some new place where they got all these things. They started going to many places. They went to universities. They went to cafes. They went to psychotherapists. They went to the movies. To make this point more credible, we can give it a name. It's a fallacy. Call it the fallacy of decomposition. As the mansion of religion decomposes, no new single mansion springs up to take its place, but instead a patchwork, a variegated garden. And I wanted to ask whether you thought that science was the new monoculture that rises up in the place of the estate of religion, or whether it was just one part of that garden, and what else is in that garden? Is there a place for philosophy, for literature, for poetry, for laughter?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great point. And clearly, there's not this narrow substitution. You know, it's not like you get rid of the belief in Santa Claus and then you get a new belief that's doing exactly what the belief in Santa Claus did for you. And science is only, science, I think, as you would agree, is only part of that, of what rushes in to fill the void. And I think it's, we have to recognize that it already has done this on almost every other question, except for questions of morality, meaning, and spiritual experience. You know, it's certainly done it on medicine. I mean, you look at we did come from a time where the good doctors of the church could diagnose epilepsy. You know, they diagnosed it as demonic possession, the cure for which is exorcism. Now, occasionally you find some group of misguided people who are performing exorcisms on their children and not taking them to neurologists. But neurology has stolen that ground from under religion's feet. And science has done this on a host of other questions, but it's not only science. I mean, it's art, I think we do. I mean, we are handicapped because we don't have a vocabulary in science, and many scientists are not disposed to explore sacred experience. And I think there is a room for the concept of the sacred. And I think I applaud Stuart Kaufman for wanting to reinvent the sacred. I don't happen to agree with just naming renaming the universe as God and then changing faith to being our admission that we can't account for all the variables in phase space, I don't think that's the way to do it. I think it's going to be sniffed out by religious people very quickly as being somewhat disingenuous. But we do need to recognize that people have profound experiences that can be hard won. You know, I mean, someone who goes into a cave for a year and practices meditation or prays to Jesus has an experience that most of us don't have most of the time, and perhaps not all of us are capable of having because we don't have the right genes or the right neurology. And yet, it makes it no less interesting, and it makes it no less relevant to our discourse about human happiness. So, whether that's a contemplative science that emerges, or whether that's some other domain, I don't know. But the thing that I do know is that we should punish people rhetorically whenever they claim to know things they clearly don't know. And we do that effortlessly in every other conversation except on the subject of God.
So. All right, thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Let's move on. So actually, on your point, Austin, one of the things that we're trying to do here, obviously, is to recognize that point, and that's why I have some people who are working in literature. Robert's demonstration yesterday of some of the delights of music was supposed to be along those lines. But and I also noticed that after the fires, that although most of the newspapers had front-page stories about people flocking to churches, which is quite appropriate because that's where they could get community stuff and so on. I didn't see many stories about the huge increase in email at places like the Salk Institute of people who didn't even know each other offering places to go and stay. So I think that those kind of communities also exist in other